The second case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of SAAA, EA, and AA, alleged abuse and neglect of children under South Dakota policy. Minors are referred to by their initials. The attorney for the appellant, Father H.A., is Mr. Richard Johnson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. It's my understanding you'll be going first for 11 minutes and do the rebuttal, counsel. Then we also have Amanda M. Wilcoxon, who is the attorney for the mother, H.A., correct? And you'll be speaking for 9 minutes. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Assistant Attorney General Ann Holhauser, who will be speaking for 10 minutes. And then also Cynthia Howard, who represents the appellee minor children. You'll be speaking for 10 minutes, correct? Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 11 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Richard L. Johnson from Sioux Falls, and I'm representing H.A. Father in this matter. H.A. Father asks the court today to adopt a rule which allows parents in abuse and neglect cases to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against them, even if those witnesses are children, their children. Specifically, we ask the court to adopt the rule of Crawford versus Washington, which was a Sixth Amendment case applicable to criminal proceedings, that said that the testimonial statements of witnesses absent from trial can be admitted into evidence only where the declarant is unavailable and only where the defendant has had a prior opportunity to cross-examine the declarant. In this case, I urge the court to apply the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Due Process Clause, and also Article 6, Section 2 of the South Dakota Constitution, the Due Process Clause of the State Constitution, to find that one of the rights that parents are entitled to in these proceedings is the right to confront and cross-examine their children. In order to test the accuracy and the reliability of statements made by them.
But aren't our focuses different? I mean, the courts have a parents patriae standard where we're supposed to protect the interests of children. In a criminal case, if under Crawford the child will not testify, that may result in the dismissal of the case for the state's case is not proven beyond a reasonable doubt and the defendant goes on their way. But in a A&N proceeding, if the same sequence happens and we buy your argument, the child may very well be returned to an abusive situation. How does that square with our duty to protect the best interests of the children?
I think that the best interests of the children may be in some circumstances that the children should be returned to the parents. Perhaps these allegations are not true. And if they aren't true, then in fact the court is not supporting the best interests of the children because it would result potentially in the termination of the parental bond. If these statements have been procured by social workers or police officers the wrong way so that in fact they're not true, and these statements come into evidence and are the basis for an adjudication of abuse and neglect and later the basis for termination of parental rights, then the court has failed in its duty to protect children.
Mr. Johnson, can you remind me what process or procedure did you go through to request that the child be questioned? Did you do any requests to, or did you subpoena them, or did you request any kind of a deposition or anything like that?
No, Judge, we didn't request a deposition. In the adjudicatory part of these proceedings, I objected several times to the statements on the basis that they were hearsay and also that the father would not have the right to cross-examine the children. At the end of the adjudicatory trial, during the closing argument, the trial court informed us that we would have the right to call the children if we wanted to. That was a surprise to all of us. At least it was a surprise to me. I've never seen children called in those proceedings. So then the attorney for the mother said, well, we could call one of them if the court wants. And at that point, the trial court said, well, you had your opportunity to present evidence, and so that was pretty much it. In the dispositional phase, again, I objected specifically to the allegations of S.A. that there was sexual abuse. These statements were coming in through out-of-court statements through hearsay, and I objected on the basis of the right to cross-examine as well as hearsay. The court denied that and analyzed it from the point of view of saying that the right to confrontation doesn't apply to these proceedings. Then the court invited us to possibly, because we were told we could subpoena the witnesses at the adjudicatory phase, the attorney for the mother did subpoena the children. The court said that we should indicate what issues we wanted to examine the children on, so the attorney for the mother did that. And the court then told us what issues the court would allow us to talk about, and the abuse of the children was not one of those issues. Now, the court said that the reason for that was because the abuse had been determined at the adjudicatory phase. But at least for my client, there was a significant allegation in the dispositional phase, the allegation of sexual abuse, that didn't come up in the adjudicatory phase. So we were precluded from talking to the SA, the girl, about that issue.
Was that an indication that that was what the trial court based its opinion or decision on to terminate parental rights?
Certainly one of the issues, yes.
And that's listed in the findings of fact?
I believe it is. And I think that it's very significant because Dr. Pribble, who gave the tests to Father H.A., indicated that the test results show that his interest was not in children sexually, but it was in adult females. So the objective testing would have indicated that that he was telling the truth.
Even if you remove that part of it, wasn't there a lot of evidence of abuse other than sexual abuse?
There was evidence of discipline that went too far. Again, I would argue that the children should have been able to be cross-examined on those issues, and those are the issues we raised at the adjudicatory phase. But the court did not see it in terms of the right to confront. The court saw it in terms of the hearsay and the reliability issue. I think if we would have been able to cross-examine the children at both the adjudicatory and the dispositional phase, but in the adjudicatory phase in regard to the other abuse, we would have been able to show that that perhaps this didn't occur.
Well, tell me exactly what prevented you from subpoenaing the children at the first hearing, at the adjudicatory hearing. I didn't see anything in the record that prohibited you from issuing subpoenas, hauling these kids before the court, and asking them any question you wanted. I didn't see where the trial judge placed any limitation on you in that regard.
I don't think that any of us realized that could be done. We've never experienced children being allowed to testify.
Well, then, excuse me to interrupt, but if you just didn't do it, the Constitution only requires an opportunity to cross-examine. And it seems to me that you had an opportunity, you just didn't use it. Whether it's because you didn't know about it or for whatever reason, the fact of the matter is you had an opportunity at the adjudicatory hearing.
I guess I'd answer that in two ways. One, I don't think we knew we had the opportunity. And if we knew we had the opportunity, we would have done it as we did at the dispositional phase. And the second thing is, I guess I'm not sure how far the court would have allowed us to examine the children at that time at the adjudicatory phase, because the court limited it also at the dispositional phase. And when we did subpoena at the dispositional phase, the trial judge would not allow cross-examination on abuse, and the allegation that came up at the dispositional phase, I think, was a significant allegation.
But then don't you object and make your record and maybe even make an offer of proof as to what you would be able to do if the court didn't make such an excessive ruling?
I think in the adjudicatory phase, that's probably true. And I think we did that in the dispositional phase by raising that issue. I think the other problem here was that this Crawford case had not been decided at that time. I don't think any of us were familiar with any case where children had been allowed to testify in these proceedings. And so we were sort of groping in the dark, trying to preserve our client's rights, but not knowing exactly how the best way was to go about it. The court did then, in the adjudicatory phase, find the children to be abused and neglected, and I think in the written opinion, the court expressed concern about the credibility of the children and expressed the fact that the court would have wanted the children to actually be there to testify. There were numerous inconsistencies in what the children said about the physical discipline.
You have 2 minutes.
In one particular case, one of the witnesses testified that as the children were talking about this abuse, they were laughing hysterically. And when asked, well, wouldn't that raise a question of whether they were telling the truth, the answer was that sometimes they do this when they're actually telling the truth. So I think there were issues that really should have been explored through confrontation. The Supreme Court has said that children have a fundamental liberty interest in the care, custody, and management of their children. At least 3 courts across the nation have extended the concept of fundamental fairness to include the right to confront and cross-examine children in these particular instances. The trial court can protect the interests of the children through various means and still allow the right to confront and cross-examine. In a case that was cited by the attorney for the children, In Re Jam J, the court allowed the rule that the parents should have the right to confront their children and set factors that the court should consider in determining how best to do that. The trial courts in this case could do that just as well. So H.A. Father would ask this court to adopt this rule, to remand the case to the trial court, and to ask the trial court to analyze this under the terms of the right to confront the children, and to allow that to happen and to adopt a policy that would protect the children as well as protect the rights of the parents.
Can I just ask one more question here before you sit down? Is the error that you're assigning here the fact that the hearsay testimony came in also? I mean, if the hearsay of the children wouldn't have come in, then you wouldn't have had any right to confront because it wouldn't have been there.
Right. I think under the hearsay rules, the rules of evidence, there is a statute that allows these statements in. So my only objection and my only problem with it is that the parents didn't have the right to confront. I think it is a separate issue.
Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilcoxon, you have 9 minutes.
Please support counsel. Good morning. My name is Amanda Wilcoxon, and I represent the appellant mother in this case. I know the court has spent time talking about due process with regard to the issue of the right to confront and cross-examine. However, I would also like the court to talk, and I would like to talk to the court about due process with regards to the standard of proof in a termination case, in an abuse neglect case. The United States Supreme Court in Santosky versus Kramer held that parents in A&N proceedings must be afforded due process. They must have fundamentally fair procedures. And so therefore, in an abuse and neglect proceeding, the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that termination is the least restrictive alternative, commensurate with the best interests of the child. Now, mother asserts that this did not happen in this case. The state did not meet their burden in allowing the court to terminate. Following adjudication...
I'm going to interrupt you. But I couldn't tell exactly, and I haven't had a chance to read the entire record, but did, during that year period of time when they were in foster care, I'm assuming, were there any overnights or weekends, or how much contact did the parents actually have with these children during that period of time?
Justice, there were no home-based services provided. And
so the children weren't even allowed to go home on a weekend or any kind of, it was all supervised visitation?
To my understanding, yes. And it was limited to one weekly visit, and I believe it was for 2 hours.
Okay. So the state then took the children out of the home, and really they never had any opportunity during that period of time to have the children back in the home for any observation or anything like that?
No, they didn't. And because of no home-based services, the parents were never able to show all of that they had learned through this proceeding. As the court pointed out, this was a year. And the parents, you know, mother made every single visit with the children except for one.
Well, how do you answer then the argument that part of the problem is that the parents never admitted to any abuse? So how do you deal with abuse if they never admit to it?
And Justice Meyer-Henry, that is, I think, what the trial court here made the determination based on, is that because there was no admission, there was concerns for safety of the children. And I guess the point that I tried to make in my brief is that you're talking about the department making the decision to ask for termination because there was no admission, despite everything that had been done here. And I mean, as far as what mother did, mother had a house, mother had a job. They maintained communication. I know the department had problems with honesty because they don't believe that the parents ever admitted. She obtained mental health evaluations. She went through individual counseling. She went through marital counseling. She completed parenting classes at the outset of the case. I think that was one of the first things that was completed. She obtained, missed one visitation throughout an entire year with her children. There was never an issue with drugs or alcohol, so that was not addressed. Anger management, the Department of Social Services asked that mother complete an evaluation to get into the Family Violence Project. Mother completed it and was not recommended for the program. So mother went back again and obtained another evaluation. It was also found not to be appropriate. She went back again. And so at the time of disposition, I'd say this is the only goal that was not completed because of how long it took to get into it. But she still went back. She still got into the program. She still continued with it. She also did individual counseling there as well.
So what are you asking this court to reverse it and say that the least restrictive, how would we reverse it? What would we actually reverse and remand to do? To allow them more services, or to determine that this is not the least restrictive alternative, or what exactly would you be requesting that this court do?
Well, I believe that definitely to determine whether there's a lesser restrictive alternative here, and I think the lesser restrictive alternative was home-based services. That could have been implemented. The department shall provide reasonable efforts to the family, and the goal of any proceeding that is delayed before disposition is for reunification of the family. And the problem that we have here is because the department never got an admission from the parents, the department made the decision that they learned nothing. No matter what programming they did, and they went to everything, they did it. No matter what they did, they were not willing to give them credit for anything that they had done, and just made the flat-out determination the parents had learned nothing, that this whole year had basically been for naught, that they didn't do anything, which created a roadblock. I mean, the department, because of that, they were asking for an admission, and they just wouldn't look at anything else.
Isn't that the whole why we have trial courts, to hear the evidence and decide whether or not this abuse was taking place? Because hypothetically, let's take a case and assume that parents were actually physically and sexually abusing their children, and they go through every program the state has available, but they deny and deny and deny. And at the end of a year of going through all those programs, if there's serious sexual and physical abuse going on, even though they successfully completed the programs, the court can't put those children back in that home. Hypothetically, they couldn't, could they?
Judge, I believe that, you know, one of the ways to look at that and to assess the safety of the children was to provide the home-based services.
But if they've done everything they could do and they still deny it, but it was happening, you wouldn't want those children to be put back in that home, would you?
I think that by providing the home-based services, you can still ensure the safety of the children. I was not suggesting, and I don't think anybody suggested, just to return these children home without any kind of supervision. And during that whole year, that's what could have happened. They could have started gradually and done an overnight visit or done a supervised visit in the home.
How would home-based services help? Because home-based services take place in the home, and these parents aren't going to sexually or physically abuse their children when the services are being provided in their home. They're going to do it when nobody's there.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. And I understand the court is obviously concerned for the safety of the children. And I guess I go back to, with this admission, that the department says they're not admitting, so therefore nothing has been done. You're talking about the department asking for something from a parent that has already developed a distrust of the system. Every time that mother would start to open up or would admit to something, I think one of the instances was the admission that there had been problems in the home between her and father in the past. As soon as that was given to the Department of Social Services, to the social worker, instead of, you know, I guess being happy with the fact that they got that, they were referring more services. And that was used as a main reason at termination, at the dispositional hearing. That was cited. So every time mother would give something, it would just be used against her, I guess. And so you're asking for somebody who already has a distrust of the system because they've taken her children away to admit to something, and they're not taking into consideration everything that she's done. Everything that all of the programs would have done for her. And I don't think that anybody would say that after going through all of that programming that somebody's not going to have changed in some way or another, after counseling, after classes. I think that parents put forth a tremendous effort here, and I think that the department put up a roadblock because they didn't initially get an admission, so they weren't going to give them credit for anything that they had done. And I would urge the court not to lose sight of the fact that this is a family. This is a family, and I know we're talking about best interests of the children here, but the best interests of the children, you also have to look at it with the view that it is to be in a safe home, but it also is to be with their family.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Holzhauser, you have 10 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Holzhauser, an assistant attorney general appearing on behalf of the state of South Dakota. With the permission of the court, I'll direct my argument this morning to the issues regarding hearsay and the right to confrontation addressed in the order for supplemental briefing. Counsel for the children, Ms. Howard, will direct her argument primarily to the issues regarding waiver and harmless error. By way of a brief summary of the facts in this case involves an abuse neglect proceeding where the children were removed after bruises were discovered on one child and after he disclosed that his mother had hit him. During the adjudicatory hearing, out-of-court statements were accepted, brought into the record through the testimony of various professionals that had talked to the children, not just the child, whose bruises had prompted the removal, but the other children as well. All 4 of the children were found to be adjudicated, abused, and neglected by the court. Thereafter, services were provided by the department for over a year, at the conclusion of which a dispositional hearing was held. Again, out-of-court statements made by the children, all of the children were admitted through the testimony of various professionals. The parents continued to deny that they had abused any of the children, and they continued to deny that there had been domestic violence within the home. The court terminated the parental rights of the parents to all 4 of the children, and this appeal has commenced. The issue that I'd like to begin this morning addressing would be whether or not the court erred in admitting the hearsay. From what Mr. Johnson had indicated in his remarks, he perceives that issue as being separate from that of the right to confrontation. However, he continues to rely on the Crawford case, the Crawford v. Washington. So in a sense, there, I'd like to address a connection that could be made between the two. Crawford v. Washington, as the court is aware, is a criminal case, a United States Supreme Court case, addressing the right to confrontation in criminal cases under the Sixth Amendment. It represented a fairly dramatic change or switch in direction in the analysis of whether or not hearsay statements can be admitted in criminal proceedings by requiring now, as far as criminal proceedings, that the parent or that the witness either be available or subject to prior cross-examination. The ramifications of the Crawford v. Washington case in the criminal context are not clear. However, what it suggests is clear is that the courts in other states have been limiting the Crawford analysis to the criminal context and have been refusing to apply Crawford to, in particular, to abuse and neglect proceedings because such proceedings are civil cases. Mr. Johnson had mentioned that three other courts have found that Crawford applies in abuse and neglect proceedings. I'm not aware of that. It's my understanding that I believe that there is one other state that has followed that analysis. To the extent that Nebraska has a statutory right to confrontation, so I suggest that would be different.
But instead, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because they still may have the right to cross-examine under the 14th Amendment due process.
Well, whether or not they have the right to cross-examine under the 14th Amendment comes down to an analysis under that amendment, the due process analysis being the three-factor test that the United States Supreme Court has put forth in addressing what procedure is required or whether or not the procedure that is in place is fundamentally unfair. Under that analysis, I'd suggest that not only do the hearsay statements come in, but the determination whether the hearsay statements come in is not dependent upon whether or not the child is available. That analysis looks at the parent's interest, the private interest that's involved, and has been addressed in the brief. A parent's interest has been deemed to be fundamental. The state does not dispute that. But on the other hand, that interest has also been found to be not absolute. The parent's interest in abuse and neglect proceedings is an interest in the care, custody, and control of his or her child. But in addressing the due process analysis, we must look at not only the parent's interest, but the child's interest as well. At the adjudicatory phase in an abuse and neglect case, the child has an interest in maintaining the connection or the relationship with the parent, but the child also has an interest in avoiding further abuse and neglect. Okay.
I'm just going to interrupt you before I forget here. How much of this argument was actually before the trial court?
Well, the parents, particularly the father's parent, had brought up the issue, had questioned whether or not the admission of the hearsay statements in the adjudicatory phrase, whether or not the statements could be admitted on the grounds of whether that violated his right to confront the children. However,
was there a determination by the judge at that time on whether the availability issue at all? Did the judge address that?
I think the judge addressed it at the end of the hearing by pointing out to appellant's counsel, to the parents' counsel, that they had not put that issue on the table, so to speak, by calling the children as witnesses, that they had the right to do so to the extent that there is nothing under the statute that prohibits them from doing so. Whether or not they would be allowed after requesting that would be a different determination. And I think that assessment comes also back to the three-part analysis, the balancing of the interests. When it comes to whether or not parents can cross-examine their children, I think the court, because of requirement that the court consider has been discussed earlier, the best interest of the child. The court needs to look at not only, or the court needs to take into account what effect, the effect that calling the child to the stand could have upon the child, the further trauma that the child may incur because the child is called to the stand and examined regarding those statements. Those considerations have been taken into account, not in an abuse and neglect case, but in criminal cases before the United States Supreme Court in the Maryland v. Craig case. A recognition that public policy mandates that we take into account what effect calling, cross-examining the child may have on the child. Children are not adults, as we know, and I'd suggest that in a sense, 1916-39, which is the provision under which the statements were admitted in this case, itself represents a balancing of those interests. It's limited to certain types of statements. It's limited to those witnesses who our legislature has deemed to be the most vulnerable.
But these kids were like 12, 10, and 9. Were they about that age at the time of the hearing?
At the time that I think the statute suggests that we look at the time that the statements were made. And at the time that the statements were made, I believe the eldest child would have been 9 years old or 9 and a half.
Okay. I need you to straighten out one factual matter before your time runs out. Mr. Johnson has suggested that there was one incident of abuse that he was precluded from confronting or cross-examining on. Something was brought up at the dispositional hearing. It wasn't brought up at the adjudicatory hearing. Do you know what that is?
I believe he's referring to the sexual abuse allegations.
That was not brought up at the adjudicatory hearing?
No, that was a disclosure that was made subsequent to the adjudicatory hearing. And I think Ms. Howard will address issues regarding whether or not the parents properly made an objection in the record to that. It's my understanding that they had called the child, but then they agreed to the format, the procedure which the trial court had suggested as far as questioning that child, were asked following the questioning by the court whether they had any further questions, indicated that they did not. So we're given the opportunity to ask further questions, but didn't do so after agreeing to the procedure that was followed. But again, I believe Ms. Howard may go into that in further detail. In summary, I would suggest that the hearsay statements of the children were properly admitted in this case, that to the extent that there is any right to cross-examine the witnesses by the parents, that right, as Ms. Howard will address, has been waived, that it's not an absolute right, that it's a right that comes down to the balancing of interests between not only the parent, but the state in protecting the interests of the child, and the child in being free from further trauma and further abuse.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Howard, you have 10 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Cynthia Howard from Sioux Falls, and I represent the children in this case. As an introduction, I want to reiterate but also expand on what Mr. Johnson said. The Crawford decision is a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that says that in a criminal case, the reliability of testimonial hearsay can only be determined by cross-examining the declarant. It says that in order for testimonial hearsay to come in a court case, there has to be an opportunity to cross-examine the declarant. And I think it's important for this court to keep in mind, one, that it applies to criminal cases, but also that the ruling only applies to testimonial hearsay. In this case, this is not a criminal case, and it's my position that unhinges that requirement that it has to be tested, the reliability of the hearsay has to be tested by cross-examination. I would submit that in an A&N case, since it's a civil case, reliability can be tested in one of a number of ways. And the statute under which this hearsay was admitted, SDCL 19-16-39, sets out some of those ways. The court has to determine that the time, content, and manner of the statement, circumstances of the statement, show that it's reliable. It has to have indicia of reliability according to the statute. And if it meets those standards, it is possible for the court to admit that hearsay. Beyond that...
So you're essentially saying that a father has the right to confront and cannot be convicted on this type of evidence without the right of cross-examination, but he could lose, in a civil matter, he could lose his children and the right, his parental rights could be terminated on that type of information.
In certain cases, yes. But the court is also required to have a higher standard than a normal civil case. The court has to find that the evidence is clear and convincing. If the parents request confrontation, the court can perform a balancing test to determine whether or not confrontation is required in the particular case. The first point of my argument is that the attorneys for the parents did not properly make their request for that sort of confrontation. And as the court's questions to Mr. Johnson pointed out, prior to the adjudicatory hearing, everybody got notice of what hearsay the state intended to introduce. Everybody got notice that the state was planning to introduce hearsay statements of the children pursuant to 19-16-39. Neither of the parents' attorneys objected to that notice. Neither of the parents' attorneys asked for a hearing prior to the beginning of the adjudication. Neither of the parents' attorneys subpoenaed the children or made a request to the court that the court talk to those children. I would submit that they waived that argument at the adjudicatory phase. At the dispositional phase, they did subpoena the children, and they told the judge that they would like the judge to question the children about the abuse that had taken place. The judge said, I'm not going to do that. Neither of the parents objected to that procedure. Neither of the parents objected to what the judge outlined he was going to ask the children about. At the end of the questioning, the judge said, does anyone else have a question? And neither of the parents' attorneys raised a question. So my first argument to this court is that the right to confrontation in this case has been waived. My second argument to this court is that even if there was a right to confrontation, not having confrontation in this case was harmless error. As I said at the beginning, the Crawford ruling applies to testimonial hearsay. Most of the hearsay that was admitted in this case was non-testimonial. It was not hearsay that was obtained in questioning in a manner that would give the children the message, this is going to be used in court. When the first child talked about abuse with his principal, he pulled up his shirt and said, look what happened to me. No one questioned him. He pulled up his shirt, he showed the bruises on his back and said, look what my mom did to me. That's not testimonial hearsay.
But the interviews by the police were certainly testimonial.
And I
would suggest that the testimony by Ms. Brazel probably was testimonial as well, although you might argue about that one.
I would agree that the interviews with the police could be determined to be testimonial.
And clearly when he says, look what my mom did to me, that's testimonial, isn't it?
I would say no.
Why
Judge.
Is that?
It's a spontaneous statement. He has no idea what his teacher's going to do with that statement. He has no idea that the teacher in turn has to call the police because of that. He's just showing his teacher some bruises. In addition to that statement, there were statements made to Dr. Kaplan as part of a medical examination that would not be testimonial. I agree with Judge Zinner's concerns that the statements to Colleen Brazzo might be determined to be testimonial. But again, she was incorporated into that medical examination that Dr. Kaplan did. Then the children made statements to a therapist at the Children's Inn. The three older children all went to a therapy group at Children's Inn, and as part of that therapy group, they talked about getting hit with spatulas, they talked about getting hit with belts. The boy that had made the allegations at school repeated the allegations that his mother had hit him. Those were not testimonial statements. Those were statements made as part of a therapy group. Then we have the statements made to Tara Olson Larson. She's the therapist who has seen the children, saw the children over a number of months. Again, the three older children all revealed to her that they'd been hit with spatulas, they'd been hit with belts, they'd been slapped. Those are not testimonial statements. They're statements made as part of therapy. The oldest girl's allegations of sexual abuse were first made to Ms. Olson Larson. Again, it was part of the therapy process. They were looking through a workbook on what constitutes abuse. The oldest girl spontaneously said, the oldest girl spontaneously turned back to a page that dealt with sexual abuse and said, "What if this happened to me?"
Now, was she about 9 at the time of that statement?
She had just turned 10. She was 9 when the children were placed into care and turned 10 before the adjudication.
2 minutes.
Thank you. I would submit that this is a case where there was an overwhelming amount of evidence to support Judge Nealis's decision. At the adjudication, Judge Nealis did not place much weight on the statements made to the social worker and the police officer. He put his emphasis on the statements made to Dr. Kaplan and Dr. Kaplan's finding that the bruises on the boy's back were a pattern injury that could not have been caused accidentally. That was the basis of his decision. And I think that this court needs to give a great deal of deference to the decision that Judge Nealis made after hearing all the testimony from the witnesses. Likewise, by the time of the adjudication, or the time of the disposition, the parents had not just denied that there was physical abuse, they had gone out of their way to deny that there was any abuse. Police reports were read to the father. He said he didn't remember, he didn't know what had gone on, but he certainly never hit his wife. 4 times, I believe, he was arrested for simple assault, and he denied every single incident. The mother was confronted with reports from Children's Inn, going to Children's Inn and saying, "My husband's angry all the time, he throws things, he's threatened to kill me, he's threatened to kill my mother." She practically accused the witness from Children's Inn of forging her signature on their forms. These were not parents who just denied abuse because they were angry at the system. They denied any problem at all in their relationship and their relationship with their children. I don't think that this court can find that Judge Nealis abused his discretion in deciding this case the way that he did. And I would ask this court to uphold his decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I just want to clear up the fact that these three cases that apply the right of confrontation don't all apply Crawford. 2 of them apply the right to confrontation in these cases. 1 of them bases that on the Crawford decision. In that case, I think it's AGG versus Commonwealth of Kentucky, there's some language in there that it's not to be used as authority, at least in July, so I don't know what the status of that is now. But the Nebraska case, it's true, in Nebraska there is a statute that provides for rights, including the right to confrontation. But in this case, In re Heather R., the court says the fundamental fairness concept of the due process clause of the 14th Amendment informs our assessment of the protections which are appropriate in juvenile matters. So I would say that the 14th Amendment, and in South Dakota, I think it's Article 6, Section 2, are the basis for the right to confrontation in an abuse and neglect case. Secondly, the state and the attorney for the children seems to say that the statute 1916-39 addresses the issue of reliability and balances the interests involved. I think my response to that is the quote by Justice Scalia in Crawford versus Washington, which says, dispensing with confrontation because testimony is obviously reliable is akin to dispensing with jury trial because a defendant is obviously guilty. I think that the right to confrontation is a separate issue from the issue of hearsay.
But just a minute, you know, Justice Scalia said that, but again, he also said that's a procedural right that applies in criminal cases, and that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing again with a more flexible constitutional concept, and that is one of due process. So I'm not sure you can use some of Justice Scalia's statements under the due process analysis. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I do disagree with that. I think it can be used in this context. It's true that Crawford is a Sixth Amendment case and applies to criminal cases, but the right to one's children, the parental rights, is certainly a precious right. And I believe that that the fact that a person should be able to confront witnesses is a right that the Due Process Clause allows. It is flexible, that's true, and that's why I think the court can make some adjustments. The court doesn't have to just allow a child to be placed in a courtroom and confronted without some safeguards. But I think it's up to the trial court to make that determination, and that's where the flexibility comes in, I think. In the criminal context, obviously the person has the right to be confronted in court. As stated in this case that counsel for the children cited, In re Jam J, there are other ways to allow the right to confront and still not subject the child to harm. That's where the flexibility is. So I think we can actually quote that. The right to confront is a precious right. In regard to the issue of waiver, I think it's in the settled record number 149, Mr. Cheddar, the attorney for the mother at that time, wrote a letter to the judge listing the items or the issues that he wanted to discuss with the children in chambers. One of them was whether prior abuse occurred in the home, the nature and extent of any such conduct, whether the children sustained any injury, and whether EA ever sustained any cigarette burns. Again, the court limited what could be asked of the children before we were even in chambers to talk to the children. So when the question came, are there any other questions that you want to ask the children, I think that we assumed that are there any other questions within the context of what the court has allowed that you want to ask the children. And obviously, since we couldn't ask the children about abuse, there weren't any other questions that we wanted to ask.
Did you raise a formal objection to the court's order of limitation?
No, we didn't. I'd raised the issue of the right to confront earlier, and when Mr. Cheddar suggested the issues and the court limited them, we did not object after that. That's true.
But don't you have to take the position that the trial court erred when he limited what you could do? I mean, that's why you're there, that's why you're defense counsel, that's why people are appointed counsel, to, you know, you don't have to buy into everything the trial court judge, does you?
That's correct, yeah.
And the South Dakota legislature has provided an automatic right of appeal to everybody who feels aggrieved by a circuit court decision.
That's correct. I think that we assumed that the court had made the ruling on the right to confront, and so that was where it stood. I mean, we had asked for this issue of abuse to be discussed with SA and the other children, and the court denied that. The attorney for the children also raises the issue of whether these statements are testimonial. again, in the Crawford case, and I think this is also cited in this Commonwealth of Kentucky case, statements that were made under circumstances which should lead and would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial are in the nature of testimonial statements. All of these statements that were made by the children are testimonial, in my opinion. All of these were made in circumstances that would lead people to believe that they could be used later at trial. The statements in the adjudicatory phase of the case and in the dispositional phase of the case.
Well, even Crawford recognizes spontaneous declarations are not testimonial. That it explicitly acknowledges that.
Yeah, it does. But there are so many of the statements here that were elicited by social workers, by doctor, by police officer, that I think the majority of them certainly were testimonial in that regard. In regard to the factual issues here too, the attorneys indicate that there was domestic abuse. I think that their evidence will show that any evidence of domestic abuse was many years before that, 7 or 8 years before this hearing. And that's what the parties were in counseling for. That's what the parties were taking the domestic abuse counseling for. And I think that their testimony indicated that they were, in fact, learning something from that. And they were, in fact, realizing that there were problems. They had to go through that counseling in order to finally get to the point where they were able to admit it. That should be the goal of the state, to help them deal with that so they can get their children back. But instead the goal seemed to be to terminate the rights. I'd like to also address the issue of the least restrictive alternative. That's the other issue that I think is important, and it's been addressed by the attorney for the mother. But in this particular case, I would also argue that termination was not the least restrictive alternative. The least restrictive alternative would have been to allow home-based services for these parents and children. I think it's important to note that Dr. Sivison, who was the psychologist in this case, who always seems to be the one that the state goes to for testing of the parents, indicated that HA was an above-average parent based on the interview and test, and the results of the test were consistent with the interview. He said that he had a strong sense of family and was doing as well as he can with the resources he had, and he recommended that reunification should take place. Now, it's true that H.A. didn't talk about any of the domestic abuse, but these are objective tests. Same is true with Dr. Pribble's test. These were objective scientific tests. These people are scientists. And yet, when the tests indicated that H.A. was a good father or that he probably didn't sexually abuse his daughter, they were disregarded. Also, as stated by the attorney for the mother, these parents did almost everything, because they really wanted to have their parents, their children back with them. They had a home, they were both employed, they cared for the children during the visits, and they didn't miss any, my client didn't miss any of the visits. They kept
Mr.
in
Johnson,
contact with the social
I'm gonna,
worker.
Mr. Johnson, yeah. I'm going to interrupt you. Just what you're asking then this court to do with this argument would be to make a determination that the trial court abused its discretion, or that the findings of fact were clearly erroneous, or exactly what is it that you're requesting?
I think that the trial court abused its discretion in terminating parental rights, and I think also that the findings of fact were clearly erroneous in regard to certainly the sexual abuse issue and some of the other discipline issues, and that it should be remanded so that the right to confront and cross-examine can be applied. But also it should be remanded so that home-based services can be applied. Again, there is a strong bond between these parents and children. The children wanted to be back with the parents. The parents wanted to have their children, and they did absolutely everything they could to try to get them back.
Let me ask you, since you have a couple minutes left, or a little less than that, the same question I asked before. How would home-based services make a difference? Because these parents aren't going to sexually and physically abuse their children in front of somebody that's providing services in the home. It's going to happen when they're not there.
There's always a risk, I suppose. But I think when the evidence, the objective evidence indicates that there was no sexual abuse, And when they're going through domestic violence counseling to alleviate that problem, the state has to take a risk and give them a chance to show that they've learned something, that they've changed. And this wasn't done. There's always a risk that something might happen. That's part of life, I suppose. But in this particular case, these parents certainly have done more than about 95% of other parents that go through these proceedings to show that they were changing and that they wanted an opportunity to show that they were good parents.
And your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.